Parshas Behaloscha begins with HaKadosh Baruch Hu giving Aharon the mitzvah to light the neros, the menorah, daily. And Rashi asks the question, why is this parsha of the menorah following right after the 12 offerings of the princes of the other Shvatim? He says, Aaron, when he saw the splendor of the 12 Nesiim, princes bringing their offerings, he was upset. Says, right, Chol Shadaitoi. He became despondent, depressed, or whatever, that he had no part in it. Hashem said to him, Chayecha, I promise by your life, Shechcholcha Gedolosh Melohem, I've saved for you a greater task, Shatamadliku Meiti Vesaneirois, that you are going to light, and you're going to take care, you're going to prepare for lighting the menorah on a regular basis. Now, my friend notes that this parsha has a couple of two instances of this notion of feeling left out of a mitzvah. And because I feel left out, I didn't get the opportunity to do a mitzvah, I become despondent, I become upset. So this is the case here with Aaron. And then we move into the parsha a little bit later, and we're told about the only offering of a Korban Pesach from the time after Yetzias Mitzrayim until they came into Eretz Yisrael, or just before that. And that is in the second year. And we have the story that people were carrying the aronos, the coffins, or such as they were, of Yosef HaTzadik, or the other Shvatim, and therefore they were Tamei Meis, and they could not bring the Korban Pesach, and they used the same word, Lama Nigara, why should we be excluded? Why should we lose the opportunity to do a mitzvah? And we know that the Torah, in the merit of those people, gives the halachos of Pesach Sheni, that they have a makeup day. It's the only mitzvah that has a makeup because people really felt left out. We have one other instance in the Torah near the end where the daughters of Selofchat said the same thing, Lama Nigora, why should we be precluded from having property in Eretz Yisroel? Owning property in Eretz Yisroel and taking care of it is such a high level of a mitzvah that they too asked Moshe, why are we excluded? And HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave the law that surviving daughters without sons could inherit, provided that in that generation they would marry within their own shevet, so that property would remain static in each tribe's unit. There wouldn't be someone from another tribe inheriting property through his wife in a second tribe. Second possibility. Rabbi Friend says he knows of two other incidents where things like this happened. And he tells the story that in Radin, where the Chafetz Chaim was a Rosh Yeshiva, one very, very cold wintry night, one of the students in the yeshiva stayed up late. He was working on a very intricate sugya topic in Gemara and in Halacha, and he didn't leave the Beis Medrash to 2 o'clock. So he walks out of the Beis Medrash onto the freezing cold street, and lo and behold, he sees the Chafetz Chaim, and the Chafetz Chaim says, "What are you doing? Why are you up? I want you to go to bed immediately. It's cold, and you need your sleep. Go." And you don't argue with the Chafetz Chaim. He went ahead and he did it. And this individual happened to be a boarder by the Chafetz Chaim's sister's home. So in the morning, he said, "Could I please ask a question?" He says, "I was amazed. What is the Chafetz Chaim doing walking the streets of Radin at 2 a.m.? If it's cold for me, how much more so for him?" And the Chafetz Chaim's sister said that, "You don't understand. This is the second night in a row he's done this. He hasn't had the opportunity yet to say Kiddush Levana. And so he walks for hours at night hoping to gain a view of the moon that he can be Mekadesh L'Chodesh." Again, this love for mitzvos. Then my friend says that he has a close friend. I think he says Rabbi Lubin, who lives somewhere in New Jersey. And he said Rabbi Lubin told him the story that one year his father-in-law, an elder Yid, right, who learned in the old country, was by him for Sukkot. And he said, "Unfortunately, it was the first night, and it's pouring, as we say, torrentially, and you can't go out." As my friend says, most people would say, "You know, if that's what happens, happens. I can't do anything." He said he watched his father-in-law with tears in his eyes, saying, "Nebuch, Nebuch, Negev, we have this mitzvah of Sukkah. How am I going to be able to do it? I can't miss out." And Rabbi Friend says that's the inner strength of the Jewish people, that there are those who are so spiritually attuned that they can't stand to miss a mitzvah. And they have an effect on us that when we hear their stories, we begin to appreciate in a more, let's say, intellectual level, how important keeping a mitzvah is. Okay. The question is asked by the Mefarshim. So we see that Aaron, a Kohen, was despondent in that he didn't get to partake in the inaugurating sacrifices for the Mishkan. And the question is, why? The Tiferes Tzion says Aaron didn't do it because he knew that in Moshe Rabbeinu's opinion, the means of transportation were superfluous. They really weren't needed. Moshe believed that the same way we were always taught that the Aron carried those attached to its poles, the entire Mishkan would have carried itself. It would have, in other words, it may have had an honor guard, but they would have flown off the ground as well together with it. So if that's the case, he didn't want to be involved in offering wagons, which the other Nisim did, 6 wagons to carry. But Hashem accepted the Nisim's offering and the wagons. So Aaron understood that his cheshbon had been wrong. And therefore, he said, if it was required de facto, right, in effect, to give them, I'm sorry I didn't participate. Hashem, as we said, noticed our own despondency, and that because that he had been left out, and Aaron first said, well, maybe I've been left out because the korbanos are similar in some way to the golden calf, and because of my part in that aveira, Hashem wanted me excluded. I am not able to, quote, dedicate this Mishkan. But his cheshbon in that way was wrong. We're given a mashal, right, a metaphor, that a king was going to have an amazing banquet in an area, and he invited people left, right, and center, everyone. In that area, the king had a knight, bishop, whatever they had, who was exceedingly close to the king, and yet he didn't get invited. And he said to himself, I wonder what I've done to, you know, tick off, embarrass the king or whatever. As he was fretting, a special courier came with a golden trumpet, and he said, the king is inviting you to a private party, just you and he, your family and the king. You are so special, you cannot be included with the hamoinam, with the other individuals. My love for you is much greater. You need a private audience. Hashem had the same reaction to Aaron Avinu. He said, in effect, Aaron, there's no reason for you to be upset. You are going to get a mitzvah that surpasses anything that the Nesiim, the princes, have done with their dedication offerings. You're going to prepare the menorah, and your descendants will do so as well. And the mitzvah of the menorah is one that's going to last unabated until, right, the time of Mashiach. Now, we know that when the Mishkan and the Beis HaMikdash didn't function, there was no menorah. However, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was saying to Aaron, your descendants, the Chashmonoim, Matithyahu Kohen Gadol, and his family, are going to bring the second, the Hanukkah we serve now, which goes on until Moshiach. They are going to relight Torah in the hearts of every Jew when it seems like the Greek Syrians were going to demolish it. And we look at the wording, Bahaloscha es haneros, is not the normal verb, lahadlik, as we say, lahadlik der shel Shabbos, to light. Bahaloscha means you will gain elevation. But not only that, by your doing the mitzvahs, you will elevate all of Klal Yisroel. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu was giving Aaron another message. We know that we say every day, Yotzer Aruv Arei Choshech, right? We talk about Hashem creating the splendid lights, the lights in the heaven, right? HaKadosh Baruch Hu created, right, light. And yet, somehow, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants the light of Klal Yisroel. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is saying, the most important light in this world are the lights lit by the Jewish people. because those lights are lekavod Hashem. They're for God's honor. Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't comprehend this originally, we're told. When he went into the Mishkan, there were these amazing lights of the Shekhinah. Any human light pales in comparison. HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, yes, but I want you to realize something. And so I'm going to give you the mitzvah of the menorah such that the three wicks on the left and on the right all tilt towards the middle. The middle light is representative of the Shekhinah, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence. And this was so that we should realize that all light that we see, we should consider connected to the Shekhinah. And Aaron understood this. We're told that Aaron was tall enough that he could have lit the menorah standing down on the ground of the Kodesh, the Ohel Moed. But he always went up the stairs as if to say, to light a Kadosh Baruch Hu's light, I've got to elevate myself. The other thing we know is when we read the Karbonos in the morning, that the mitzvah of lighting the menorah was in two parts. First five lights, then another avod, and you came back with the last two, to show that this was a mitzvah that encompassed more than one action. It says the menorah is mentioned often there in the Torah, and Chazal learned new halachos of the mitzvah from each of these occurrences. Once Aaron is given that avoda, HaKadosh Baruch Hu delineates, as he, I guess we have it in last week's parsha, the tasks of Gershon, Kohath, and Merari, of the three families of the Levium. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu needed a special, or wanted a different, HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't need, a special dedication ceremony before a Levi would assume his responsibilities. The Levium were told that they have a special task in Klal Yisrael to be involved with the Avoda, and they were also given the task of teaching Torah, of being those who would teach the rest of the Jewish people, right? They went through a process of tahara, basically recreating, so to speak, a new soul, similar to a mitzora, where all the hair on the body is shaved. They're sprinkled on day 3 and 7 with the paraduma. They bring special korbanos to be inaugurated. And like a korban, the levi is waved up and down, left and right. This is an act of sanctification. Chazal asks, why do the levium have to remove all the hair? Why are they shaven of all their hair, like a mitzora? It says this is a kapara. The Levium took the place of the previous servants to Hashem being the Bechorim. And the Bechorim, unfortunately, had been contaminated in the sin of the golden calf, because when Moshe Rabbeinu said, "Mi Lashem Eli," who amongst the camp is going to act for Hashem? It was only the Levium who didn't participate in the sin of the golden calf, and they all assembled to do what Moshe wanted. Because they were bringing kapara for the Bechorim, the Bechorim, because they had been on a higher level, had become quasi-mitzorim, like they had become like lepers because they had a tint of avodah zarah in being able to not protest at the golden calf. Excuse me. And so this was some type of representation of atonement, more for those possibly who they replaced than for themselves. That's why each brought a chatas when they were inaugurated, so to speak, to expiate or take away the sin of the Bechor they replaced. We're told that on the first day, Aaron had to inaugurate 22,000 different Levium, and Aaron was given the task to lift and wave every Levi. You can imagine trying to lift 22,000 people, the strength required, and I don't know how much time it would take, but it was likely done with a nace and some portion. This waving was to show the Levi that he was now a Kenyan. He was now acquired by a Kaddish Baruch Hu in the service of Klal Yisroel. They were given the tasks initially to be the assistants to the Kohanim. They acted as guards, as gatekeepers of the premises of the Mishkan. They were the singers in the choir on the Duchan, on the platform in the Beis HaMikdash. And they were given the job, as we learned last week, of physically not just caring for the mikdash, but also of in transport. They were the only ones allowed to move it or have it move. A Levi became an apprentice to learn the avoda at age 25. For 5 years, they were taught all the intricacies. And at age 30, they would begin serving whatever tasks they were given. At age 50, a Levi was quasi-retired in that the Levi was no longer allowed to move heavy objects in the Mishkan. We know, for example, they had to move the Mishkan itself and other things in traveling. And they were given lighter tasks, it says, such as opening, closing the gates, assisting in the loading of the wagons where they put the crushes, the heavy-duty outside perimeter pieces of wood. In the Beis HaMikdash, right, it says, however, they would continue in avoda after age 50. And now it doesn't say here whether Hashem gave them extra strength at that stage to be able to do so. And a Levi would participate in the choir until the point in time where his voice was waning, had decreased because of age. Okay, we're going to stop here today.